actually turned the mic up too far, so I'm going to turn down a little bit. We're going to start today by continuing DNA replication. And that means you need handout 11.3. And if you didn't get one last time or you didn't bring yours, there's more over here. Now, I accidentally forgot my large and colored chalk, so I'm going to have to try and write big with regular chalk. I apologize if you can't see it. If you're having trouble in the back, there's lots of room in the front. I just want to remind you that I have office hours today from 4 to 5, and there will be TA office hours next week because of the exam, but one of the TAs will have office hours Friday from 1 to 2. That's in 744 Mudd, right near my office. And remember, there's a makeup lecture tomorrow here at 10:35, and it will be repeated not next Monday, but the Monday thereafter. If we repeat it next Monday, which is the Monday before the exam, I am sure attendance will be almost zero since the material is not on the exam. So I'm repeating it a week from Monday, but late at night, at 7:30. If there are people who have trouble with that time, let me know. I'm not planning to change it, but if there's a major issue with a lot of people, we'll see. Now, last time I demonstrated with Velcro, but did not write on the board, how DNA replication begins. And we have it up here, and it's on 11.3, that you have to unzip the DNA. And that uses a bunch of enzymes that we are not discussing. Once the DNA is opened up, now the DNA strands can be used as template to make their complement. Now, the way we drew the Meselson and Stahl experiment, we just took the two strands, Watson and Crick, apart, and we made the complement to one and the complement to the other. Now, the net effect is you take them apart and make the complement to one and complement to the other, but it doesn't happen that way. There is a single replication fork or group of enzymes that move down the DNA, unzipping a little bit at a time. So what happens is, remember that DNA polymerase, and this is also true of RNA polymerase, all these polymerases only add to the 3' end of a growing chain. So all chains grow from their 5' end by repeated addition to their 3' end, from their 5 to their 3. And they're always anti-parallel to the template. So with this in mind, all these arrows here go from 5' to 3'. The left strand here has its 5' end at the top, has its 3' end at the top. And so the complementary strand can be made from the new strand here, starting as its 5' end, continuously down to its 3' end. However, on the other side, here, this is which end of the DNA? This is the 5', not the 3', and all new chains must be anti-parallel starting at their 5'. So that's why we have to start back up here and have a kind of retrograde synthesis back up to the top. Now, you can write this down if you want, but I recommend scribbling on your handout. And if you like having a clean copy to take home, take an extra. Now, then we're going to unzip the DNA some more. So here in step 3, we've unzipped the DNA further. And now we want to use these two regions here as template to continue making DNA. Now, on the left side, the growing strand, this is which end of it? This is its 3' end. We can add one nucleotide at a time to the 3' end, no sweat. So this strand just continues. And in fact, we'll be able to keep on making this strand continuously as we go on down. So this is called the leading strand. And it's made continuously from one end to the other. But on the other side, we can't continue growing this strand down because this is the wrong end. This is the 5' end. So in fact, what we have to do is start over again, further down, retrograde, and go back again. And so we're going to have these two sections here. First, we're going to make the top one. Then we're going to start down here and make the bottom one. So we're going to have discontinuous synthesis on the other side, and this is called the lagging strand. This is why you need the enzyme ligase. These short fragments, which aren't more than 1,000 bases long or nucleotides long, are called Okazaki fragments after their discoverer. And they have to be joined up. Because when we get finished, we want to have a complete complement to the right side. We want the lagging strand to be continuous when we get done. And to do that, we need one more enzyme. You need the enzyme ligase to join here. And if you do that, and last time we skipped steps 5 and 6, if you throw in ligase, which is what step 7 is, you end up now, leading strand is fine, and lagging strand has been joined, so it's now okay. And now you just repeat those steps. You unzip, the continued leading strand is elongated, you put in an Okazaki fragment on the lagging strand, ligase joins it up, you keep going to get to the end. Now, the trouble is, we left something out. According to this picture, and everything we've said so far, what do you need to make DNA? You need the unwinding enzymes, which we are ignoring. Then you need DNA polymerase. Then you need deoxynucleoside triphosphates to add on. And you need ligase to join it all up. And you need pyrophosphatase to get the energy. So far we've said you need pyrophosphatase. If you don't remember why, look it up. You need pyrophosphatase. You need the polymerase. You need the unwinding enzymes, which we're ignoring. You need the deoxy XTPs, and you need ligase. So, and of course you need DNA to act as template. So if you put all of that in a test tube, will you make DNA? And the answer is no. Obviously this is a setup. So the question is, what else do you need? And you need one more thing because of the problem of one of the features of DNA polymerase. DNA polymerase always adds to the 3' end, anti-parallel to the template. And another property it has is that it can only add. It cannot start a new chain by itself. So somebody else has to get started, and then DNA polymerase can add on. So if you look more carefully at your handout, you will notice there's something here. There's a little dot here at the 5' end of each chain. That represents the short section which is made first so DNA polymerase can add on to it. So if we sort of blew up this thing, here is our template strand. We have to make a short section, anti-parallel, and now DNA polymerase can come along and add to it. So this is what DNA polymerase does. But this is the short section that somebody else has to make to get started. This short section is called primer. And in living cells, it is made not of DNA, but of RNA. And the enzyme that makes these short RNA sections is a special RNA polymerase, which is called primase. So you need primase RNA polymerase adds nucleotides one at a time exactly the same way DNA polymerase does, except you use the ribo XTPs, nucleoside triphosphates, and of course you use U instead of T. So, if we had primase present, we would start by making a short RNA section, and then DNA polymerase would add to it. We would make a short RNA section, and DNA polymerase would add to it. Then we would unzip the DNA. Now, for the leading strand, we just keep going, same as before. So leading strand has a primer on the end, but the rest of it's no problem. You don't need any more primer. It just keeps going. But what about the lagging strand? We had a little bit of primer here and a little bit of primer on the 5' end of each Okazaki fragment. Now, when we get all done, we want one continuous DNA strand, no RNA. How are we going to get rid of the primer? And that's what the two missing steps are about. So in step 5, what we've done is to degrade the primer on the first Okazaki fragment. So if the primer is chewed out, there's a short section here that has to be filled in. Before, with ligase, all we did with ligase was to join two ends. But now there's a space in between the two ends. So we have to fill it before we can use ligase. And that's what step 6 is. What happens is the end of the second Okazaki fragment, well, which end is this? 3' or 5'?
5. 3.
Because remember, we're growing this way. We're growing up. So this has to be the 3' end. And now DNA polymerase can add to the end of it and fill in the hole. And now we're all together. And now ligase can join these two in step 7, and we have two, a complete leading strand and a complete lagging strand. Now, this has a complication, which I think will be clearer if we do a little Velcro stuff here. So here would be our DNA. We'd open it up at the fork. So how are we going to make our new DNA? So we have to put in, let's see. This is a 3' end, so we can start 5' end on here. So we need a little primer. And then we can start making DNA. We can start making the complement. I have a long strand somewhere. Aha, here it is. So let's just assume we continue it. So DNA polymerase takes over from primase, adds to the 3' end, one nuclei at a time. There we go. Now what's going to happen on the other side? Where are we going to start? Remember, this is the 5' end. So we have to start down here and go up. So we'll put, say, some primer about here. And then we'll have... DNA polymerase can take over and go up to the end. Okay. But now as we unzip further, what's going to happen? The leading strand can just continue. We can just keep on going. In fact, we have one long leading strand, so we'll forget about it. But what's going to happen over here on the lagging strand is we're going to have another primer down here somewhere. And then DNA polymerase takes over. But what probably happens, in the original picture, we chewed out the primer first in step 1, and then we filled in the hole in step 2. These probably occur simultaneously, that the same enzyme, one part of the enzyme, chews up the primer, and another part of the enzyme extends the chain until they match up. This is a little, if you think about an old-fashioned railroad engine with a cow catcher, you know? It pulls the chain, of cars. It pulls things, but at the same time, it clears off the tracks in front. So the same enzyme is actually degrading. The same enzyme is degrading the primer, one part of the enzyme, and another part of the same enzyme is adding on to the 3' end of the next fragment. So simultaneously, we're filling in and chewing off. Now, this means that DNA polymerase has at least two different enzymatic activities. It has a polymerase activity. It adds nucleotides to the 3' end. We talked about that last time. But what about the part here where we're chewing up primer? Maybe it's easier if we look at our blow up here. This is a little strand of RNA, 5' to 3', and we're chewing off one nucleotide at a time. We're actually hydrolyzing the bonds in the polynucleotide. That kind of enzyme activity is called 5' to 3' exonuclease. It's a nuclease because it hydrolyzes or destroys polynucleotides, chops off nucleotides. It's called an exo because it starts at one end and breaks one bond at a time. An endo would dive in the middle and break. But this is an exo, chews off one at a time. And it's called 5' to 3' because which end does it chew from? It chews from the 5' end toward the 3. Now, as we will see next time, DNA polymerase, some of them at least, have a third enzymatic activity. They have a 3' to 5' exonuclease. And what that allows them to do, what would that mean, 3' to 5' exonuclease? That would mean chewing, say, from here off one at a time. This actually allows the enzyme to back up if it made a mistake, chew off the nucleotide, throw it away, and try again. Now, it's important to realize that these are not... A 3', 5' exonuclease is not the reverse of the polymerase reaction. What would be the reverse of the polymerase reaction? Is if we put the pyrophosphate back on and released a nucleotide-side triphosphate. But in fact, we release a monophosphate. And we'll talk a little bit more about that time, next time, about this correction mechanism. Okay. But now we want to consider... All right, let's keep it up here. So let's do it one more time. One more... we'll put the last primer on. And then we'll make the last, and we'll add to its end, replacing the previous primer up to here, and we'll join it with ligase. Now, the only problem with this is this primer on the end. You can chew it off, but how are you going to replace it? Normally, there would be another end, another fragment. It would have a 3' end. We would add to it, but there's nothing there. For most bacterial DNAs and viral DNAs, which are relatively small, the solution is to have circular DNA. Because if the DNA is circular, we have a 3' end to add on to. We can start here and just fill it in. And almost all bacterial and viral DNAs are circular. However, the DNAs of your cells are linear. They're very long and linear. And as a result of this phenomenon, every time your DNA is replicated, the ends get a little bit shorter. Now, this is not so serious because you have on the ends of your chromosomes repeating structures, repeating sequences of DNA, which just say gobbledy, 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 or gobbledygook, 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 gobbledygook. And so when you chew those off, it doesn't make any difference. If you chew in too far, though, it may matter. Now, we're not going to talk about that now. We'll talk about that when we get to eukaryotes. But in case you're interested in this and you want to look it up, the technical term for the special ends are telomeres. And under certain circumstances, they can be repaired using an enzyme called telomerase. But since this is a eukaryotic problem with a eukaryotic solution, we're not going to talk about it more now. Now, in the notes, we skipped the section about bidirectional replication. And I want to go back and look at that. That's diagrammed on the bottom of 11.3. I just said that most DNAs are circular. But when we talked about DNA replication, we said that I drew a linear picture. I said you unzip at one end and you have like a fork, and then the fork moves down unzipping. But if the DNA looks like this, how do we pull that off? If the DNA is circular, you have to start in the middle. There's no alternative. So you have to unwind it and take the two strands apart, just like drawn on the bottom of your handout, where you see there's a bubble in the middle. Now, in your handout, we've just drawn from where between my two fingers, I haven't drawn the rest of the circle. But you have a bubble in the middle. So what happens is you have two forks, not one. So if I start right here, and I go, what is by you, what, clockwise? Because if I go clockwise, so this is just a fork, like on that picture. This is just a fork. DNA polymerase moves around. Continuous on one side, discontinuous on the other. But then I have another fork going counterclockwise. I have another DNA polymerase complex going around the circle the other way. Now, what the consequences of that are is drawn on the bubble on your handout. So if we look at that little bubble there, you see we've opened the DNA up, and the two strands are anti-parallel, and we started DNA replication in the middle. This is called the origin, or the origin of DNA replication. And we have one fork going to the left, and one fork going to the right. But on each fork, we have to have continuous and discontinuous replication. So we have every new strand is anti-parallel to its complement. And so the picture looks like this. Okay, so one fork going to the left, continuous leading strand on the top, discontinuous lagging strand on the bottom, and the reverse on the other fork. Now notice, discontinuous synthesis is different from bidirectional replication. You have discontinuous synthesis above, but only one replication fork. Here you have two replication forks. Each one has discontinuous synthesis on one side or the other. Now, to be sure you got it, I'm going to label these Okazaki fragments A and B. And I want to ask you to discuss with your neighbor for a minute, which one was made first? Okay, discuss it with your neighbor for 10, 15 seconds, and then we're going to take a vote. Which one was made first, A or B? First. Now, what I should do is what one of my colleagues does is he makes you close your eyes. You can't see how your friends are voting. So, how many people think A? We have a couple votes for A. How many people think B? How many people are undecided? Nobody will admit to it. Okay, so we have a few A's, but mostly B's. So, what's the rationale for A? Well, it's called A, right? But which way is the fork on the left going? The fork is going that away. Another way to say it is, this left, if it's rotated 90 degrees, is the picture on the top. And you notice that we're going down this way to the left, so we had to make this one first, A, B first, A second, and join them with ligase. Now, I think the best way to be sure that you understand what's going on is when you get home to take this picture on the bottom and write in all the 3' and 5' ends. And if you can do that, then you got it lit. Now, let me ask if there are any questions about this before I go on. Let me just say that there is a picture like this one up on the right. There's a picture like that in your notes, which is the same as the right-hand side of the fork, which is up and down, which is the same as the AB part that we just started talking about. So let me ask if there are any questions about this, about replication forks, before we go on.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned that exonucleus could go, not exonucleus, but another enzyme could go back and check if there's a mistake. How would it know?
Okay, how would you know there's a mistake there? You'd know there's a mistake because there wouldn't be a proper pairing between the new base and the base in the template. We'll talk maybe a little bit more about that's called proofreading, and we'll probably talk about it a little bit more next time. Yes?
Why doesn't the DNA just unzip all at one time?
Why doesn't DNA unzip all at one time? The reason is it's incredibly long, and it would get all tangled up. And also, single-stranded DNA is unprotected and easily damaged. So this means that there's very little single-stranded DNA at any one time. Almost all DNA is double-stranded. So it's apparently a technical problem. Yes, did you have a question?
Why can't DNA polymerase be, like, join the fragments? Why
can't DNA polymerase join the fragments? It doesn't have the enzymatic ability to do that. Ligase is a different chemical. It looks here like DNA polymerase has all these other activities. Why doesn't it have that one? But it doesn't. So you need a separate enzyme to do that. Yes?
What makes single-stranded DNA so fragile?
Well, it's not protected by the lid, so to speak, by the other half. Also, if you have single-stranded DNA and you mess up a base, what was it originally? But if you have both halves and you mess up a base on one half, you know what it should have been because of the other half. So both double-stranded DNA is physically, apparently, more stable. I don't know if you've noticed with those fiddlestick models I have, but the double ones don't fall apart nearly as easily as the single ones do. But in addition, it's more repairable. You have a redundancy of information. Okay, so what I want to talk about next is a lab artifact of the way DNA replication works. But this lab artifact is incredibly important. We told you about the Nobel Prize for Peace for GFP, you know, our department, yay. But even so, GFP has just revolutionized the ability to do certain kinds of experiments. People talk about before GFP and after GFP. Well, PCR, or the polymerase chain reaction, which is what I'm going to talk about next, which is on the handout for today. This is polymerase chain reaction. Has had a similar effect, maybe even a bigger one, on our ability to analyze DNA. People talk about before PCR and after, you know, like instead of BC and AD, they talk about BP and AP. So it's had an enormous effect because PCR allows you to make copies of DNA. Even small traces of DNA can be copied, and you can make enough of the DNA to analyze. And this is what has enabled all the use of DNA in forensics. And a classic example of the advances in it are in one of the articles that's handed out today about the JonBenet case, where very small amounts of DNA were amplified into a big pile, and then that pile, that DNA, when you had many, many copies, you could do chemical tests on it. So, how does PCR work? And, of course, the inventor of PCR received a Nobel Prize also. His name is Carey Mullis. And on the handout for today, on one side, is a sort of mini biography of him. He is a very unusual scientist. Some people would say bonkers nut. And it sort of explains something about him. But whatever else we think about him, we owe PCR to him, and it's a wonderful thing. So, the whole idea of PCR is that DNA synthesis will not start without a primer. Therefore, if you have a very long DNA sequence, you can pick where you want to start replication. Because you can, instead of relying on an enzyme in a living cell to make primer, you can make primer in a laboratory with whatever sequence you like. Well, suppose the DNA is like this,
So if we make its complement, which way will we do it? We have to do it that way, anti-parallel. So if the primer is complementary to this section, we'll make this DNA. But if the primer is complementary to this section, then we'll start here in the middle, skip all that stuff on the left, and go to here. So by the suitable choice of primers, you can force DNA replication to start wherever you like, and you can copy whatever subsection you wish to copy. That's really the basic idea. So let's look at the handout now, which is 12A, which diagrams the steps of PCR. Now, I forgot my colored chalk, so we'll use dots instead. Stuff like that. Okay, so here's our starting DNA molecule. I've made one strand thicker than the other to keep track. Maybe we'll call that Crick and this one Watson. And suppose the only part we want to make a lot of copies of is the part in brackets. So this is the part we want to make a lot of copies of, not the rest. Now, I'm going to explain the basic principle first, and then I'm going to go through the handout. Now, if we have a primer that starts here, that is, it's complementary to Crick. In this picture, it's a white primer. If we add that primer, it will stick to the right place. And now if we add, but let me say I didn't draw it, we would have to denature the DNA first. In DNA, in living cells, you don't completely take the two strands apart. But in PCR, in a test tube, you take the two strands apart and you make the complement to Watson separately from the complement to Crick. Therefore, no replication fork, no discontinuous synthesis, no RNA ligase, no ligase at all. So if you take the two strands apart and you add the complement, the little primer complementary to Crick, it sticks here. And now if I add DNA polymerase, which way will it go? Which end will it add to? We draw all these arrows, 5 prime to 3 prime, and everything is always anti-parallel. So if Crick goes up, the complement goes down. So we would make a new strand, and we would go all the way to the end. We would make a new Watson. But what if we had a primer to Watson? Here. That's one of those black primers. Now we add DNA polymerase. Which way will it add? It will go the other way. So we would now make a new Crick. And I'm going to draw it heavy to make it clear that it's a Crick. Okay, suppose we denature this mess. And now we take this new Watson over here. And we add another copy of the black primer. So that means same as this one, but another copy. Where will it stick to our new Watson? It will go here. Now, if I add DNA polymerase, what will happen? Up, right? But is it going to go to the end of the original? Notice the template ends here now. So the DNA will go up to here and stop. Well, I should go to the end of the primer. Same thing over here. I add a new copy of primer, of the white primer, hybridizes here. I get a new Crick. Now, what if I keep going? I'm just going to keep copying this piece over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. I'm going to make umpteen copies of the section between the two primers. The first time, I skipped and started in the middle, and I ignored the end. The second time, I started in the middle and ignored the end. So I cut off one end one time and one end the other. So to get it straighter, let's look at our picture. The secret to this is every time you have a cycle, you do 3 steps. You denature the DNA to take Watson and Crick apart. You add primer, which hybridizes to your single-stranded DNA, and then you add DNA polymerase and let it add or grow a chain or elongate. So denature, hybridize, elongate. So how does that work here? So we want to go back to our original case. Our original molecule on our handout looks like this. So the first thing we do in step really zero is we denature it. And this is B. So what do you do after you denature? You add the primer. So we have two primers. We have the little dark primer, black primer here, and the little white primer here. And each one is complementary to one end of the section that we want to copy. Okay? After you hybridize, you add DNA polymerase, and it elongates. Just as we did before, it's going to elongate this one up and this one down. Now, what we have now is E. This has now been converted to E. We have step E. We've done step 0, step 1, and step 2, and now we have E. That's one cycle. Now we do it all over again. Now what happens if you, what do we do all over again? We denature, we hybridize, we elongate. Okay, so this is cycle 1. Now we denature, so what's going to happen? We're going to take the two halves of the left molecule apart, two halves of the right molecule apart. The left half of the left molecule is the same as what we had before. So we're going to ignore it. It's just going to do the same thing over again. So we're going to forget about this one. And we're just going to worry about the shorter one that we made. Similarly, not going to worry about the far right one either. Because these are what our two new molecules that we made look like. So now they're separate from each other, and we can add primer. We add more molecules of the same old primer. But now the dark primer always sticks to Crick, to Watson, and the white primer always sticks to Crick. So where are our primers going to go? I drew it on the inside on your handout, so I'll draw it here. Dark primer goes there. Light primer goes here. So I just carried out step 4, and now I've got G. Now what happens if I add DNA polymerase? It always adds to the end of the primer, goes to the end of the molecule. So it's going to do that. Whoops, all the way to the end. And now we've got the end of cycle 2, and this is H. Well, what do we do now? Same old thing over again. We denature the DNA to take the strands apart. We add primer, we elongate. But when we take these two apart, one of them is the same as we had before. So we're not going to worry about it. And the one on the right is the same as we had before. But these two in the middle are new. These two in the middle are the ones that are the length that we want. So now we take it apart, and now we want to start cycle 3. So you do step 6, take them apart. And now you have this one and this one. Sure, I have it right, yes. I want to get the thick and the thin right. Okay, now what? We add primer again, and we elongate. So this time, the primer just goes on the very end of the respective molecule and goes to the end. Now, what have we got here? We have got a copy of the part we wanted to copy. Now, what happens if we denature this and add more primer and more DNA polymerase? We will get exponential replication of this DNA. One of these will make 2, 2 of these will make 4, 4 of these will make 8. In a very short amount of time, we'll have a bucket of copies of this particular DNA. One of the great advantages of the system, which is not obvious until you think about it, is the thing you want after this point is replicated exponentially. 2, 4, 8, 16. But the number of copies of these funny things that have one strand longer than the other only increase linearly. So after 10 cycles, you have buckets of what you want and just traces of what you don't want. Now, when you get all done, how do you separate what you got at the end from all the other garbage? The usual way is to use gel electrophoresis to separate the various DNAs by length. Remember that you can use SDS gel electrophoresis to separate proteins on the basis of chain length. You can use gel electrophoresis without SDS to separate nucleic acids on the basis of chain length. And why you don't need SDS, I'm not going to tell you. You have to think about it. But basically, using the ability to wiggle through the gel, you separate nucleic acids on the basis of length. So you can get the thing you want away from all the intermediates and the starting stuff. Now, what would you do with it? Why would you bother to do this? Let me just repeat one more time that the whole point of this is it allows you to make easily many, many copies of a small DNA sample, and then you can do whatever test you want. For example, you can get trace DNAs from a crime scene, make many, many copies of them, and then you can compare this DNA to the DNA of a suspect. This is the primary use in forensics. Now, how do you compare DNAs? You can compare them by sequencing. That's what's done with barcoding. But in many cases in forensics, what you are comparing are the lengths of the DNA. And the reason you do it this way, and I'll come back and explain the detection in a minute, is that when they say there's a DNA database that has the DNA, say, of all the rapists and people who've committed felonies in New York State, what's in there? What's in that database? What they do is they take primers that will make copies of a particular section, the equivalent section of everybody's DNA. Now, in that section, there are a short bunch of repeats, like at telomeres. There are short bunches of repeats that don't mean anything. They say blah, 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 blah. But the difference is, at that point in the DNA, everybody has blah blahs. But some people have 3, some people have 10, some people have 25. So what they do is they add the primers, and they make copies of the distance in between the primers, and then they measure how long it is. And from how long the piece of PCR DNA is, they know how many copies of blah blah you had. Now, the trick to this is they don't do it at one spot in your DNA. They check 13 different spots in your DNA. And they measure the number of blah blahs at spot 1 and the number of goo-goos at spot 2 and the number of etoin-chirgloos at part 3. And then what they keep a record of are those numbers. Now, you're diploid. You have 2 copies of the DNA, one from each parent. So at spot A, you have 2 copies. At spot B, you have 2 copies. So there are 26 copies, 26 spots where they have the number of copies of repeats. And what they write down in the database are the 26 numbers. At spot A, one of your you have 2 on one chromosome and 42 on the other one. At spot B, you had 3 on one and 6 on the other. So it's 13 pairs of numbers, and that's what they write. These sections are so variable from person to person that if you check 26 numbers, the chances are vanishingly small that any 2 people in the world will have the same numbers unless they are identical twins. You can't prove when the numbers match that the DNA samples came from the same person. But you can show that the probability of it happening by chance is vanishingly small. That's called an inclusion. On the other hand, a match is called an inclusion. On the other hand, what if the 2 patterns don't match? If the 2 sets of numbers didn't match, that wasn't your DNA on the floor, and that's the end of it. And that's called an exclusion. And you read about these both in the paper all the time. Inclusions are used to catch people who thought they got away with it all the time. And exclusions are very often used to show that a suspect did not do it. And unfortunately, there are many cases where people have been locked up who didn't do it. And the DNA tests prove it. And one of the articles that you have today is about an inclusion, and one of them is about an exclusion. DNA evidence is much more reliable than witness testimony, as the article says. Now, what about the... So one use of PCR is to amplify small samples and compare them. Another use of PCR is for detection as opposed to identification. Suppose you have a sample and you want to know, suppose you want to know if corn has been adulterated. This is a very famous example. So what you do... Here's the corn DNA. If it has been genetically modified, it has a special sequence that was introduced by the genetic modification. If it's normal corn DNA, it doesn't have that section. It just looks like this. So now you add a primer that hybridizes to this special section. If the DNA has been genetically modified, then the primer will stick to the DNA. When you add DNA polymerase, it'll grow chains, and you'll make lots of DNA. If the DNA has not been modified, what happens when you add the primer? It has nothing to stick to. It does not hybridize, and nothing happens. So when you add DNA polymerase, you don't grow any chains, you don't make any DNA, you don't get any product. So by the ability to make product, you know the complement to your primer was there. So DNA, it's also used for that purpose. So there are a few other fine points and examples in your notes, but I don't want to go into all of them. Just to say that this technology is incredibly powerful, and with time, people have reduced the amount of starting DNA you need. Because in theory, how many molecules of starting DNA do you need? One. I think the absolute most sensitive test they have now needs 10 to 50, but they're hoping to drive it down even more. So I want to leave PCR then and come back to the biological function of DNA, unless there are questions about this. Yeah?
How long does a primer sequence have to be so that you know it's specific?
How long does a primer sequence have to be so you know it's specific? I think about 20 nucleotides long. About 20 bases. But it depends on the situation. Yes. Oh, and there is something I forgot to say, that these primers in PCR are made in test tubes, and they are usually DNA and not RNA. DNA is more stable than RNA. Since you're making the primer and you have a choice, you make the primer of DNA. In a real live cell, DNA replication uses RNA primers. Yeah, what was your question?
On breakfast shows, they'll be like, it was a 78% match, so it was a relative. How does that work?
Well, the way it works with relatives is a little more complicated, and I'd be happy to explain it, but I think it's better if we wait till we get to inheritance, and then it'll be clear. Okay. Now, DNA's biological function is twofold. As we explained a long time ago, it has two jobs that I call job one and job two. DNA has to serve as template to make more DNA, or it couldn't be the genetic material. And DNA also has to serve as a template for making protein. And what we want to start talking about today is how does it do that? Now, the answer to that is usually called the central dogma. Did I ever mention this before? I teach two classes with similar content, and sometimes I forget. The central dogma was invented by Crick as a joke, because he's a very anti-religious person. But it turns out to be a very useful concept. And one way of saying it is in words: DNA makes RNA, and RNA makes protein. And the way people often write that is DNA makes RNA. A way of summarizing what goes on in a cell, or perhaps how the information goes. The information in DNA is read out to make RNA, and then the information in RNA is read out to make protein. Now, if you want to summarize what goes on in a cell, this gets most of it. But there are two things I would add to this to sort of make it complete. Information also goes from DNA to DNA. That is, DNA is its own template. And then all the stuff that Dr. Chazen talked about is off this picture. So you also probably ought to say protein does the job. And once you put that in, this form of the central dogma sort of covers everything that goes on. Now, I want to look at this a little differently. If we started with DNA, we know how you use the DNA template to make more DNA. That's what we've been talking about, DNA replication. And that phenomenon is called replication, or DNA replication. But what we're interested in now is how you use that DNA to make protein. Well, first you have to open up a little of the DNA. And you have to use one side of the DNA as template to make the corresponding RNA. And then the RNA is used to line up the amino acids and make a protein. Now, when DNA serves as template and you make DNA, that's called DNA replication. When DNA acts as a template and you make RNA, that's usually called transcription. Just meaning RNA synthesis using a DNA template. When RNA is used to line up the amino acids and make protein, that's called translation. Now, that actually requires not only the RNA we've drawn here, but additional kinds of RNA. This kind of RNA, which serves as the template to line up the amino acids, is called messenger RNA, or mRNA for short. Now, as you might imagine, you need enzymes for all of this. You need enzymes for DNA replication. You need enzymes and other proteins for transcription. You need enzymes and proteins for translation. Why didn't I write that? Big yawn. Of course you need proteins and enzymes. Surprise. But you also need RNA, messenger RNA, to act as template. And it turns out you need two other additional kinds of RNA to act in a, not exactly partially catalytic, partially as a tool role. And these are called transfer RNA, or tRNA for short, and ribosomal RNA, or RARNA for short. So when we say RNA makes protein, we mean two ways. That RNA acts as template to line up the amino acids. That's the job of messenger RNA. But we also mean that in addition to that, you need the usual proteins, but you also need more RNA to do that. Part of the toolkit is also RNA. And we won't talk about it this time, but next time we will explain how these two fit in, transfer RNA and ribosomal RNA, and a little bit more about message, although we'll talk about it somewhat today. Today, we're going to focus not so much on translation, but on transcription. That is, how you make the RNA. You need a lot of RNA to make protein. That's the bottom line of this. And all that RNA has to be transcribed off the DNA. And what I want to consider is how you make RNA first. And then we will consider how you use that RNA to make protein. Now, before I go any further, I just want to say a few words about messenger RNA to the effect of why bother. You could use DNA directly to line up the amino acids because, after all, the sequence in one side of the DNA is the same as the sequence in the messenger RNA, except that one has U and one has T. And, in fact, the strand of the DNA which has the same sequence as the RNA is called the sense strand. That equals mRNA, except for the U versus T in the in terms of base sequence. Which strand is template to make the messenger RNA? It's the other one. So one of them actually acts as template and makes a complement, which is like the sense strand. So one is the sense strand, and this is the template. They have other names, but that's usual. So why not just use the sense strand of the DNA? Why mess around with this mRNA business? Now, there's several rationales for it. One is that you make the mRNA, basically, is a working disposable copy. DNA is very, very long. If you want to make a protein, you only need the information in a short part of it, which is what is usually meant by a gene. So I only want the information in that part. It makes sense to make a short transcript containing the information I want. It's like when you want to write a paper. This may be an old-fashioned analogy. Today people use Google, but you used to go to the library and there would be this big encyclopedia, and you would Xerox the pages that you needed for the article that you needed, and then you would leave the encyclopedia and carry off your Xerox. It's a lot easier to carry around a couple of pages of Xerox. Today you print it off Google, but it's the same idea. So it's much easier to carry around a couple of short pages than a whole big heavy volume. Much more convenient. In addition, this is a disposable copy. You get coffee stains on it, big deal. The dog eats it, whatever. Anything that happens to it, you don't care. And at the end, you're going to tear it up and recycle it anyway. So in the same way, by using RNA to actually line up the amino acids, not only is it more convenient, but it saves wear and tear on the master. It preserves that big volume with all the information, less likely to be damaged. So there's the matter of convenience, there's the matter of saving wear and tear on the original, and the other reason is that you can adjust the amount of messenger RNA you make. If you want to make a lot of protein from this gene, you make a lot of copies of RNA. You translate them all simultaneously. If you want to make just a little bit of protein, you only make a few copies of the RNA and translate those. And we'll talk more about that later. So all of these things, sort of convenience, to save the master, and for flexibility, for all those reasons, it appears to be more advantageous to use messenger RNA as your working template than to use the DNA itself, although the information in the two of them is essentially the same. Now, before we start talking about the details of how you make RNA, the question is, what the hell is RNA anyway? We keep talking about DNA and saying, well, RNA is like that, or DNA, RNA is like that. So I want you to just take a minute, maybe 30 seconds, and talk to the person next to you, and try and come up with a list of how many ways RNA is different from DNA. In terms of the sugar, RNA is ribose, DNA has deoxyribose. Okay, what's another one?
There's uracil.
Uracil is in which one?
RNA.
So RNA has U and DNA has T. Remember, they have the same hydrogen bonding properties, but they differ by a methyl. The other three bases are the same. Anything else? I should have told you not to look at your notes. What? Yeah?
DNA
is usually double-stranded, and RNA is usually single-stranded. There are cases where RNAs are doubled back on themselves, but they are generally single-stranded. There's one more difference.
The length.
Remember we were talking about the convenience business? It turns out that generally DNA is very long, millions of base pairs, and RNA is relatively short. It can be it varies from about 100 base pairs for most RNA up to thousands, but it's not millions. So these are the major differences. Now, we have spent so much time talking about DNA synthesis that the easiest way to explain RNA synthesis is by using a compare and contrast with DNA synthesis. And that's on handout 12B for today. So first, let's start with what's the same. One way to look at that is, what are the three big issues you have to worry about when you make a macromolecule? DNA, RNA, protein, what do you have to worry about? You have to worry about the primary sequence or the order of the monomers. Anything else?
Energy.
Anything else? The magic word is always the same, enzymes. Okay. So, DNA and RNA are pretty much the same when it comes to order. You use a section of one strand of DNA, take the DNA apart, and you use a piece of one section as template. So you use a DNA template, that's pretty much the same. The energy business is also almost exactly the same. That you have a growing chain, same chain is stuck together the same way. But now you would have U, of course, instead of T, but you grow the chain the same way. That is, whatever the next base is, you use a nucleoside triphosphate. You knock off pyrophosphate, which is then the pyrophosphate is hydrolyzed by pyrophosphatase, same as for DNA. And you make a phosphoester bond. So the energy requirement is the same thing, in that you start with the nucleoside triphosphate, but not the monophosphate. Now, what's really different is the enzymes. The enzyme that carries out DNA replication, the major one, is DNA polymerase. The enzyme, the major one for carrying out RNA synthesis, is RNA polymerase. Now, both of them use a DNA template to decide what base to put in next. And both of them use a triphosphate. But they have many differences. One way to put it is like this. Suppose you have all eight nucleoside triphosphates. You have deoxys, all four of them. Deoxy ATP, GTP, CTP, and TTP. And you have ribo, or the usual, ATP, GTP, CTP, UTP. You have all eight of them in a test tube, and you put in DNA for template, and you put in pyrophosphatase, and anything else you need, which we're not specifying, everything else you need. Will you make DNA or RNA? You have all eight raw materials available. Will you make DNA or RNA? Who's in charge here? It's the enzyme. If you have DNA polymerase in that test tube plus everything else, you'll make DNA. If you have no DNA polymerase and you have RNA polymerase, you will make RNA. Now, of course, to make DNA, you have to have primers or primase and ligase and all that, but the substrate specificity of which nucleoside triphosphate you use, that lies in the enzyme. So you could say that the substrate of the enzyme is different. They're not the same. Okay. One way to look at the difference is to draw this picture the way it's drawn on your handout where it says be different. Suppose we start with DNA again. And we ask ourselves, if we carried out DNA replication, what would we get? And the answer is more of the same. One copy would give us two, and two copies would give us four, and so on. But the DNA we get would be double-stranded, as you said, and long, as you said. It would be the same length as your original template. But if you made, so this is if you do replication. But if you do transcription, you're going to get multiple different RNAs. Let's suppose this is A, this is section B, this is section C. You're going to get some RNA from A, and some RNA from B, and some RNA from C. Remember the flexibility part. You won't get the same number of copies, probably, from A, B, and C. Your RNA is single-stranded, your RNA is shorter, and you get different amounts from different place size, different spots. So what must have happened is you opened a bubble here at A and made some RNA. You opened a bubble here at B and you made some bRNA, and you had a bubble at C and made some cDNA. But that's different what happened in replication. In replication, you opened it up and either from one end or the middle replicated the entire thing. You had one or more forks going all the way down the entire DNA. Now, what this means is sort of shown on the picture on the bottom. It sort of shows how this works. Here we've drawn a DNA with two bubbles instead of three to make life a little easier. If you're going to make DNA, you have to make the complement to, say, Watson, and the complement to Crick at the same time. But if you're going to make RNA, you only have to make the complement to one or the other. You don't normally make RNA, which is complementary to Watson, and RNA that is complementary to Crick. In any one section, you do one or the other. So the way I've drawn it here, on the left bubble, we've made RNA complementary to the top strand or Watson. And in the right bubble, we've made RNA complementary to the bottom strand or Crick. Now notice, I had to carry out synthesis in opposite directions. Because synthesis, the new chain is always anti-parallel to the template, whether the new chain is RNA or DNA. And if I want to go right to, if I want to copy the bottom strand, I have to go left to right. And if I want to go to the top strand, I have to go right to left. Now, in this section on the left bubble, which is the sense strand? Which strand has the same sequence as the RNA? It's the bottom. So the sense strand is the bottom, and the template strand is the top. But notice it's reversed in the other bubble. It's not true that an entire strand is sense and an entire strand is template. In any one area, one strand is sense and one strand is template. And the template strand is also sometimes often called the transcribed strand, while the sense or the anti-sense strand. And the sense strand is also sometimes called the coding strand because it has the sequence that specifies the amino acids. So let me see if I left everything out, everything in, or if I left everything out, and then we can wrap this up. So is there any discontinuous synthesis when you're making RNA? No, there's no need for it. I only have to copy one side at a time, so I don't have to worry about discontinuous synthesis. Do I need ligase? Do I need primase? RNA polymerase can start chains itself. So I don't need a separate lackey to start for me. RNA polymerase is its own primase, so to speak. RNA polymerase just starts and goes. DNA polymerase, on the other hand, is going to require primase and ligase. They're both going to require pyrophosphatase, but there's no discontinuous synthesis or fork to worry about when you do RNA synthesis. Now, the question that remains is why, when you let DNA polymerase at this DNA, you copy the whole thing. But if you use RNA polymerase, you only copy sections of it and only one side or the other. That is because the signals for starting replication and the signals for starting transcription are different. And these are the spots recognized by the two respective enzymes, and that's what we're going to talk about next time, what those are and how the enzymes use them. So how you start and stop transcription versus replication we'll do next time. So one more time, there's a lecture tomorrow here, and that lecture is repeated in a week from Monday. It says on the schedule where and when. If there are any questions, don't hesitate to come and ask. Thank you.